Welcome to episode 49, our first podcast for 2018. I'm Stuart McCullough, I'm the CEO of VHAA. And starting with this week's industrial roundup, as we enter 2018, a number of our major agreements applying to public hospitals are now entering the review phase. Those agreements entering the review phase include the mental health agreement, the nurses and midwives agreement, the health and allied agreement, and the allied health professionals agreement. What that means is that during this year, we'll be targeting our activities to put those agreements under the microscope to identify those clauses that cause confusion, those clauses that no longer need to operate, and those provisions that are having the effect of, limiting the way in which operational requirements can be met, to see whether or not we can develop better clauses for the next round of negotiations. We'll be working closely with our IR members, with our IR team members, to ensure that that occurs. In terms of community health, discussions are continuing with VAPA for a new agreement for allied health professionals, and our last meeting for that agreement was on the 2nd of February. On the 7th of February, the subgroup at the subcommittee met for community health. That's the group that is assisting us in preparing responses to the various agreements that are being renegotiated for community health. In terms of our public health service members, members will have received a bulletin and seen an update on the app that was issued on the 23rd of December with regards to a heads of agreement for doctors in training and medical specialists. We have been in a process of drafting those agreements since that time. A lot of members have asked when they can see the draft agreements. We anticipate that that will be capable of being released shortly. In terms of the Nurses and Midwives Agreement, the next meeting of the STPPWG is scheduled for Thursday the 8th of February, and we're scheduled to attend a meeting of the Rural Health Senior Nurses Executive Group on the 9th of February. There is a meeting also of the Diversity in Healthcare Workforce Group, also on the 9th of February. As with all our activities and all our meetings, these will be summarised on the VHA community app, so please keep an eye out for updates. And that's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. And joining me for this week's discussion is Senior Workplace Relations Advisor, Daniel Pullen. Welcome, Daniel.
Thank you, Stuart.
Daniel, would you do the honours and reveal the clue? I'm mindful that some of the people watching the podcast today might be first-time viewers. So just to explain to those people, this will be a clue as to what our subject for discussion today is. Could you reveal the clue? And for the benefit of those people who are listening to this podcast rather than watching, could you describe for those people what the object is?
It is a Dr. Rhythm machine.
And on the basis of that clue, what would you say the subject for today's discussion is?
Music therapists under the Health Professionals Agreement.
That's a nice try, Daniel, but you couldn't be more wrong. Today we're discussing doctors, and Dr. Rhythm is going to provide some support to us as we work through the various clauses.
Great.
So members might recall that at the end of last year, on the 23rd of December, on Christmas Eve that we issued a bulletin and updated the app to announce that a heads of agreement had been reached with regards to both doctors' agreements, that is doctors in training and medical specialists. For the purposes of our discussion today, we're going to be focusing on the doctors in training agreement. But so let's start at the beginning, and if you could recap the wage outcome that's relevant to the doctors in training agreement.
Thanks, Stuart. So all doctors will receive a wage increase of 3% per annum from 1 January 2018, 2019, 2020 and 2021.
I'm sensing there's a theme there.
There is a theme. There's an additional 6% wage increase that will be paid on the 1st of January 2018, and the total increase on that date would be 9%.
So that's an interesting thing to have four lots of three, being a total of 12%, but to have an additional effectively uplift of 6%. What's the reasoning for having that 6% as a separate and distinct amount?
So members may recall that one of the AMA's claims was for interstate parity.
Not mentioning which state, yes.
Not mentioning which state. So this will provide relief for that claim for interstate relativity, but what it won't result in is a compound effect on things like allowances, which aren't affected by this 6% uplift.
I think the other piece of context for that 6% increase is how long it's been since there's been an increase for that group. So the last increase under the expired agreement, I think, was December 2015.
It's been quite a while.
And on the topic of allowances, what's the approach being taken to the increase for allowances?
So as I mentioned earlier, the allowances will increase by 3% per annum on the same dates as the wages. They aren't affected by the 6% wage increase.
Okay, so the allowances don't get that one-off bump. They get the programmed 3% per annum increase.
That's correct.
Is that the case for all of the allowances, including the continuing medical education allowance?
So CME allowance is just a little bit different. The CME allowance will increase by a flat rate of $1,000 on the 1st of January 2018, then will be indexed by the 3% per annum from 1 January 2019, 2020, 2021.
And one of the features of this round of bargaining has been a preference for lump sum bonus payments, which seem to come under a number of descriptions, lump sum payments, lump sum bonus, sign-on payments, all sorts of things. What's the approach being taken for doctors in training?
So for doctors in training, they'll be those doctors that are employed from the 1st of January 2018 in and employed in a named employer under this agreement will receive a one-off lump sum payment of $2,000. That payment's pro rata for part-time employees, but it's not payable to casual doctors.
So sticking with those lump sum payments, we have a bit of an interesting issue for this particular cohort, I understand, and that is for doctors in training and the use of effectively short-term contracts. So generally speaking, it's the case that you must be employed at a particular date, that is 1 January 2018 in this instance. But for those people who aren't working, effectively because of for parental leave reasons, a slightly different approach might be taken?
That's correct. So, as you said, due to the unique nature of how short-term contracts are made for junior doctors, for doctors in training, there may be a small number of doctors that may not be employed within a health service that's under this agreement come 1 January 2018. And this may be because they've taken a period of parental leave that extended beyond the completion date of their contract of employment.
We're really looking for people who, but for the fact that they're on parental leave, would have been employed by one of the employers under this agreement.
Yes, that's correct.
And what should health services do in the event a doctor presents and says and identifies themselves as one of those people, that is, they would have been employed on the 1st of January 2018, but for the fact that they were on parental leave?
So we've suggested that inquiries of this nature should be referred to VHA for referral centrally to the Service Delivery Partnership Plan Working Group.
It may well be that the circumstances are quite simple, but it's very likely that there might be unforeseen things and a degree of complexity, so that will help hopefully support a quick resolution to those issues.
Yes.
With the previous agreements, we've developed materials to support the payment of that lump sum bonus through frequently asked questions. Will there be the same material again for this agreement?
There will be. So we're going to prepare material that will assist the parties in addressing the increases in wage and the back pays, the allowances and the lump sum bonus. We'll be preparing that material in consultation with the AMA, and we'll obtain feedback from the reference group prior to sending out to our rest of our members.
So just in terms of that, that's standard practice with regards to agreements, that we send out that kind of material after consulting with the relevant union. For those people who aren't familiar with it, it will go out, what is a bulletin?
Correct.
And on the app?
Yes.
And if you then go to our website and look for the new agreement, you will find all the supporting materials, including the lump sum payment guide, on that page.
Correct.
One of the items of claim for doctors in training focused on fatigue, and that was a bit of a theme for our discussions. And in particular, we had an issue with regards to the length of shift for registrars.
Correct. So under the previous agreement, the maximum rostered shift for a registrar was prescribed as 30 hours.
30 hours for a shift.
One shift as the roster is provided. So it's quite a lengthy shift to have in a roster.
By any measure.
By any measure. All parties naturally agreed that a registrar's maximum rostered shift length should equal the remainder of the doctors under that agreement, which is 16 hours.
So that's been amended so that there is consistency with regards to the maximum shift length.
Correct.
And were there changes with regards to things like backfill, as those things are often complementary?
Yes, there was some changes. So the improvements were agreed between the parties to amend the provisions to provide for backfill where doctors are on leave, where, if not replacing, will result or will likely result in unreasonable workload.
Okay, so the test here is to consider the workload impact. If it's going to have a workload impact, you need to backfill. If you manage the workload and it's not going to have an impact on others, then you aren't required to.
Correct. So the clause isn't binary. It encourages health services to contemplate the impact of the absence on workload, but doesn't require each absence to be backfilled.
And in terms of night shifts, what changes will there be under the agreement with respect to doctors working night shifts?
So the parties have agreed that a doctor moving from night shift to any other shift arrangement should be free from duty for at least 48 hours. In addition to that, a doctor can't be rostered for more than 7 consecutive night shifts.
And I take it that the reason for these were to facilitate proper rest and to deal with the issue of fatigue.
Correct. The management of fatigue and facilitating proper rest and recovery was a key claim from the AMA, and it's also subject to additional work via a fatigue management review in the Service Delivery Partnership Plan.
One of the interesting things for me as part of those discussions were issues associated with fatigue and rotations in particular. Could you just take us through in a bit of detail what those issues were?
Correct. So where a doctor is on rotation between health services, the AMA identified that that period frequently results in doctors performing lengthy shifts, followed by a requirement to vacate their accommodation and travel to the next health service without adequate rest or recovery.
So when a doctor has to move residence, there's a new requirement that's really intended to ensure that there is some degree of coordination between the first hospital and the second hospital to ensure that there isn't an unreasonable work requirement.
Correct. So part of the new clause is to provide a doctor one clear calendar day where they're required to move residence as a result of their rotation.
So I'd imagine that that will require the hospitals, the two hospitals who form part of the rotation, to coordinate.
Correct. What the clause requires is for hospital, the first hospital being the hospital they're currently employed at, and the second hospital being the hospital they're rotating to jointly contemplate before the roster is issued a number of matters. These include that the appropriate rostered ordinary hours are covered between both hospitals. There's appropriate on-call coverage, especially in our rural and regional areas. There's appropriate skill mix. Accommodation arrangements are contemplated, including any contingencies if the doctor's required to work beyond the end of their completion of what was their rotation. And reasonable time for a doctor to relocate, including time to travel to their new health service and for time to become accustomed to their accommodation.
So these things really are statements of the obvious. And for a large number of members, this will be their practice currently. But what it does by including in the agreement is provide a consistent requirement across the state.
Correct. We hope that it'll assist doctors being given adequate rest and recovery between rotations.
One of the other themes for the discussions with the AMA included discussions around the recognition of vocational training.
That's correct. So it was important to note that doctors in training are still required to participate in examinations during their employment.
So I understand that the scope of examination leave has changed.
Correct. So the parties have agreed to expand the provision of examination leave to include examinations for courses that meet a relevance test.
And what does the relevance test contemplate?
So when determining whether examination leave can be accessed for a course or unit of study, the nature of the qualification and its alignment to a recognised area of medical practice, having regard to the clinical or other work of the doctor, and also their classification and their position description are also considered.
Okay. And in terms of conference leave, were there changes to conference leave?
Yes, the parties agreed that a doctor should be able to request conference leave after 31 March of the year in which the leave will be taken, or otherwise not with not less than 3 months' notice.
So moving on to one of the key subjects for discussion, which occupied a lot of time, training time.
Yes, that is correct. So training time attracted a substantial proportion of time and discussions throughout bargaining, but also time that we discuss with our reference group. It is also going to be a topic of its own in the coming weeks.
Okay, so we'll do a podcast that is dedicated to training time shortly. But just, I think, before we talk about what the changes to training time provision was, I think it's worth describing what the changes weren't, that there is not a change to the description of what constitutes training time.
Correct.
But what were the changes?
So predominantly, discussions focused on two issues that currently arise with the provision of training time. One is how to roster training time where a health service utilises electronic time rosters. And secondly, how to reallocate training time where it was rostered but wasn't able to be taken.
From our discussions, the AMA identified a lack of confidence with regards to the existing training time provisions, which was in stark contrast to our members who were confident that doctors in training were receiving training time. And from our discussions, it seemed to boil down to a lack of confidence in the process, in that the last agreement didn't really describe how it was supposed to work. So whilst the definition for training time itself is not altered at all, there have been some changes that are intended to really deal with that concern. So could you describe what some of those changes are?
Thanks. So one of the changes that was agreed between the parties was ensuring that training time for a registrar is published in a document that's readily relied upon by all clinical and non-clinical staff within the health service to identify a registrar's hours of work.
So that provides transparency. What's the benefit of transparency there?
It ensures that the registrar receives their training time, but also ensures that other clinicians and non-clinical staff within the health service don't disturb that registrar while they're undertaking their protected training time.
It's hard for other employees to respect training time if they don't know that it's occurring.
Correct.
And in terms of the form of that document, that could be in a traditional roster or a non-traditional roster?
Correct. So a roster in its traditional sense will remain the primary method. However, another agreed document can be utilised where current rostering technology does not allow training time to be adequately published in the roster.
So there is an alternative option for those people who can't do it through the roster, but a key underpinning principle will be how is that going to be published to ensure that people are aware of the training time so that it's not intruded upon?
Correct.
And how do the parties address the issue of reallocation of training time? What we understood from speaking to members is that there were a range of approaches. Sometimes people pooled that, but the previous agreement didn't even contemplate that as a possibility. What was the approach for the new agreement?
So it was agreed that where a doctor is rostered to undertake scheduled training time but is unable to be released, or training time is interrupted due to a genuine medical emergency or disaster, or the scheduled training time does not occur for any other reason, that the health service must reallocate the training time to be undertaken by the end of the following pay period or at the registrar's election, a later roster period.
Okay, so it's not a use it or lose it principle. The objective is to make sure that people receive their training time, bearing in mind the nature of the hours of work. 38 hours plus 5 hours training time. Those hours are not to be substituted for ordinary work.
Correct.
And what if the reallocation can't be achieved?
So in these circumstances, the hospital must pay the doctor at the applicable overtime rate for the times in the roster that work was performed in excess of ordinary hours, and also pay any portion of training time that was not taken in the pay period at the ordinary rate of pay.
So really that's intended not to provide a benefit to the doctors in training, but really to provide an incentive to ensure the training occurs. All the parties were in fierce agreement that training is highly desirable and must occur.
Correct.
And how will the implementation of the training time be monitored?
So the parties have agreed to include the joint monitoring of the proper implementation of training time for registrars within the service delivery partnership plan.
Okay, so that's another issue in terms of transparency and also the provision of ongoing support with regards to implementation. So really the objective for training time, it's a bit like justice. It's not simply done, but it needs to be seen to be done.
That's it.
And in terms of a podcast for training time, we mentioned before that was going to occur. So we'll let people know when that is likely to be done.
Yes, we'd hope to be producing that within the next couple of weeks.
And with respect to something like overtime and the claims that the AMA had made with respect to overtime, what was the end result of that process?
So the entitlement hasn't changed. Overtime remains payable for working rostered hours in excess of ordinary hours or authorised hours in excess of rostered hours.
And what about health services? Can they still utilise an average over a 4-week period?
So yes, so the existing ability for a health service to average doctors' ordinary hours of work over a 2-week or a 4-week period remains unchanged.
So there were some limited instances during the course of discussions where it was asserted that some employers weren't doing it as per our understanding of how it should be done under the agreement in that compliance space. That is a different thing from saying that the terms of the new agreement have been altered.
Correct.
But has there been any clarification provided?
So there has been, and the clarification has been provided where a part-time doctor is directed by a health service to work rostered hours in excess of their contracted hours. overtime would be paid then pursuant to the clause, for the overtime clause, for all hours worked in excess of their contracted hours. But this doesn't apply to a doctor who volunteers or offers to perform additional work.
So in the context of part-time doctors in training, what you're really describing there is the same approach under every other agreement, that a part-time employee is not obliged to work additional hours. If they're required to do so, that's overtime. If they accept an additional shift, and they can be paid ordinary hours.
Correct. And that was our interpretation of the clause that currently operates with the existing doctors in training agreement.
A lot of time in our discussions was spent talking about the length of contract and a claim on the part of the AMA, in part for the abolition of fixed-term contracts, but then for two-year contracts. Where did those discussions end up?
So agreement wasn't reached on the claim for a minimum two-year contract for doctors in training. However, the parties have agreed that the service delivery partnership plan will include an establishment of a joint working party, which is comprised of representatives from VHIA, Health Services, the AMA and the department to identify a process for implementing two-year contracts for doctors in training during the life of the agreement.
So just to be clear, the SDPPWG will create a JWP for the VHAA, AMA and DHHS?
Correct.
Just one moment. So, Daniel, the other part of our discussion in terms of fixed-term contracts and the unique nature of those and their effect on parental leave, which is one of the key issues that the parties discussed, where did that discussion lead to?
So we did reach an agreement on the treatment of that arrangement, and it will be a subject of a podcast in the coming weeks.
Okay. And just as a brief summary as to how that's going to be addressed.
So the new agreement introduces provisions that enable the extension of a doctor's contract of employment in circumstances where the doctor is absent for a continuous period of 3 months or greater from their employment because of parental leave, carer's responsibilities, or family violence leave.
So under those circumstances, with an absence of 3 months or more, there'll be an extension to the contract.
Correct. This is a change from current arrangements and a substantial change from current arrangements that exist in health services. So we'll be providing greater guidance on this topic.
Okay. And there are also some common clauses that have been a feature of the other agreements that have been incorporated into this?
Correct. So the parties have agreed on the inclusion of the common clauses addressing flexible working arrangements, family violence leave, union matters, fitness for work, transition to retirement, casual conversion, consultation, redundancy, dispute resolution, discipline, full-time employment, part-time employment, and casual employment.
So, Daniel, what's next? And if you can confine your answers to the agreement as opposed to what's up next for you personally.
So Health Services would have received a bulletin last week requesting that they prepare to develop and return an eligible employee list. We may require this at short notice.
Has a ballot date been set?
It hasn't. We're awaiting the government's approval of the agreements before ballot dates can be set.
And will there be additional material available to members to support implementation?
So much like the recent agreements during this cycle, VHA will be preparing an implementation guide that will be will be conducting subject-specific podcasts throughout the implementation process to assist our members.
I think we'll also develop a list of what the implementation issues and report on that on a monthly basis through our HRIR monthly report.
Correct.
Will there be an EBA forum?
There will be. We'll be scheduling EBA forums to discuss the changes to the agreement and the implementation of these agreements. More information will be made available in the coming weeks. Will be communicated by bulletin, but also via the VHA community app.
Okay. Well, Daniel, thank you for providing that overview for the Doctors in Training Agreement. I think members can look forward to that additional material, but also the additional subject-specific podcasts that will be coming in the following weeks. I think there's no other way to end this podcast than to throw over to Dr. Rhythm and allow Dr. Rhythm to play us out. Thank you, Daniel.
Thanks, Stuart.